Radio Gorgeous presents Gorgeous Lives. Today's Gorgeous Live features Corin Drury, lead singer of Swing Out Sister. All the music on the show was chosen by Corin, featuring Swing Out Sister. Corin, who was and still is a pop star, was one of the first video stars in the UK, becoming globally famous in the 80s with her Grammy-nominated hit, Breakout. Corin talks very frankly about her life before and after fame, about her groovy parents, her dad was a pop star who played bass in a band, and her mother, who wore head-to-toe leather and had her own poodle parlour. Corin trained to be a fashion designer at St Martin's School of Art. In the day, she was working as fashion designer, and in the evening, she was out gigging and touring with the embryo band Swing Out Sister. Then they had the hit that changed her life, Breakout. We hear more about her colourful life and her childhood dream of going on tour across America, and many other fascinating stories. Radio Gorgeous presents Corin Drury of Swing Out Sister. Hi Corin, so we must start with the height of your pop stardom in the 80s. Breakout, your 1986 single, was number four in the charts. How did that feel?
It felt like all my dreams come true. It really did. I'd watched Top of the Pop since it started, which was when, about 1964, and Ready, Steady, Go, and all of those programmes, and just poured over pop music and people singing them. And so it was kind of like living out a dream.
And did it feel dreamlike, or, you know, did it feel not real?
I don't know, really. No, there was some grim reality there, like having to get up early in the morning and these long schleps. First of all, we schlepped around England in the back of a van, and we did all kinds of crazy early morning TV shows, and then Europe, and then America, and then Japan. I mean, then it got into this crazy whirlwind world. Once we started becoming successful in other countries, then it really seemed like, wow, this is really happening.
Because that was the days when you had to have a record deal. How soon did you get your record deal?
It's probably a year or so. I mean, we had all been doing other things. Andy had been in a band called A Certain Ratio on Factory Records.
So I remember them.
He
yeah,
was already
I didn't know
doing
that.
Stuff. In fact,
right.
he was moonlighting with Swing Out Sister.
Okay, cool.
And Martin, he was in Magazine. He played drums in Magazine. And I was the only one who hadn't had a musical track record, really. I was a clothes designer. By this time, not with my own groovy label. I was working for Courtauld's that was supplying some of the main high street shops, which was actually good training. I should have done that before I set up my own label.
What was fame like in the 80s? Because we do know about the kind of cult of celebrity now. What was it kind of innocent in a way?
It did seem quite innocent. There weren't any computers, no mobile phones. You know, it was kind of a bit more mysterious, really. I'm sure not as mysterious as the 50s or the 60s, but it did still seem a little bit mysterious. But it was very fast as well, because there was stuff emerging like MTV and VH1. So there was the emergence of the pop video, which kind of scooted you around the world at great speed without you having to go there. You know, you could send your music via a pop video to all kinds of places. So you felt a bit removed because of that. But then we still had to go places in person. It was great to travel. Our first album was called It's Better to Travel, and that became somehow prophetic, because that's all we did for about 3 years. I can remember once complaining to our manager that I hadn't done any exercise for 2 weeks since we were in LA swimming in the swimming pool. And he went, oh, dear.
God, sounds really interesting. So Breakout, tell me who directed that video, because I saw it yesterday when I was doing the research and I thought it was really good.
He was a guy called Nick Willing, and he was the assistant of the director who was meant to be making the video, who double booked himself doing a British Gas advert. So we went to the director's house and studio and just ran riot, really. And it was his assistant director who did the video. And it didn't turn out anything like it was supposed to do, because we didn't behave the way we're supposed to do. I think the idea, the script for the video that the director had written was meant to go somehow like, they were following my story, sort of from rags to riches, yeah, and from working in the rag trade and running around the East End to suddenly being a super superstar designer. I think that's kind of the way it was meant to go. But none of the clothes fitted me. I had said to the girl who was bringing some clothes along that I'm quite big. People don't really see that.
But I think she means tall, by the way, everybody. How tall are you, Corinne?
Oh, I'm 5'10", 11-ish. Yeah. But, you know, I like eating as well. I'm not skinny, but I know how to disguise things like that. I spent 4 years studying fashion design. So, you know, I can kind of disguise stuff. And so the ball girl who brought some clothes, I took a load of my own clothes anyway, because I thought, well, you never know. I might not like the things that are provided. And sure enough, none of them fitted. So I had to wear most of my own things and a few other things. They were meant to be colourful and bright. And I think everything started going wrong. So we were just in stitches all the way through, you know.
That's the atmosphere of the video. It's fun, you know, and that's exactly what you look like. You're having a laugh.
Yeah, and we were trying to be sophisticated, you know, going sourcing fabrics for this grand fashion show at the end. And at the grand fashion show at the end, the dress that the stylist had brought along didn't fit at all. And it was something that I really wouldn't wear. But funnily enough, when I was about 6 years old at school, we learnt how to make a sari. We had a very forward-thinking teacher at primary school. I thought, I know. There was a load of fabric that was meant to be decorating the studio. And so I just pulled down the fabric and proceeded to make a sari. It doesn't really look like a sari in the video. It's meant to be some kind of ball gown. And the shoes didn't fit, so I've got bare feet or Doc Martens on or something. And that was it. It was totally incongruous. It was meant to be a sophisticated video, and it turned out to be slapstick, you know, Three Stooges. And I think that actually sealed it for us, because we were this weird contrast of sophistication, somehow sophisticated but not quite, you know. We want to be sophisticated but really not achieving it.
Hilarious. So being a pop star is all about recording, touring and promoting. So you're on the treadmill for about 3 years, you said.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably longer. That was the most intense time. And during that time, we were nominated for a Grammy for that song Breakout. And we were touring America, doing promotional tours and appearing on every TV program.
What, like the Andy Williams Show?
Yeah, no, not quite
what,
that.
What programs on TV in America, do you remember?
Oh, we went on the Dick Clark Show, and he was kind of the guy who had started this program in the 50s. And I had some chewing gum in my mouth. And that wasn't allowed on his program. And he said, are you chewing gum? And I felt like some kind of teenager in the 1950s. It's like, it was like East of Eden or something. I'm like, yeah. But I took it out anyway. I felt really embarrassed.
Brilliant. God, it must have been just so brilliant. Now, you're the only woman in Swing Out Sister, or you were then. I know the band's changed since. How was that for you? I mean, did you feel alienated from the boys or, you know?
Not really, but I can remember one thing that I really spent time on. Was going to the loo faster than a boy, so they couldn't go, oh God, and be looking at their watch, managers, band members, whoever. I just thought, when we're at an airport or at a truck stop or whatever, I am going to make sure I can have a slash quicker than a boy. And to this day, I think I managed that, you know. And that includes washing your hands as well.
God, that's very good. But did you feel lonely?
Not really, because I don't think I'm a particularly girly person. I quite like hanging out with boys. I've got three brothers who I virtually brought up. And so it was kind of a similar situation, really. I quite liked it. You know, if you're feeling vulnerable and, you know, things like your monthly cycle, it's hard for boys to understand stuff like that. And so then later on when we went on tour, there'd be girls in the band backing vocalists. I think probably stuff like that it's easier to handle, but I think that's a minor detail. I think we've always got on pretty well. I've always got on pretty well with the boys, and I'm not such a girly girl anyway, so it didn't really matter. Forever, having a lifetime last so long. Hello, this is Corin from Swing Out Sister. You're listening to Radio Gorgeous for sisters everywhere.
So how did it all start? You're born in Nottingham. Can you tell me about your mum and dad?
My mum and dad were groovers, and I think really that probably is the reason that I'm doing what I'm doing now. One of my earliest and very vivid memories was my mum and dad's friends coming round who were in a band called the Beat Men. So this would probably be about 1964, and I would have been about 3 years old. And they turned up outside their flat in their brand new tour bus, and it had the Beat Men written along the side.
So cool.
And it was like, wow, what is this? They've got their own bus. And I went running down, toddling down the central aisle of this bus, and they are all sort of skinny jean, skinny, spotty boys. You know, my parents had me when I was quite young. They had me when I was 19, so they had only been in their early 20s. Mm. And I was going, I want to come, I want to come.
God.
And it had, I can remember it had green baize tables, sort of card tables with little lamps with tassels,
yeah,
and
yeah,
bunk beds and guitars and duffel bags. And it was like a world in a bus, you know. It was fantastic. I didn't know where the hell they were going or what they were doing, but I wanted to go on that bus. And these boys, I remember them saying, it's not a place for kiddies, you know. And I was furious that I couldn't go on this bus. I think I always thought I was older than I actually was. And I remember being so furious. I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to get a bus like this, and I want to go on tour. And I didn't even know what on tour was.
Very prophetic,
then. Yeah, it left a huge imprint on my mind. And I'll tell you about it later when we eventually did get to go on the tour bus. But I think my mum and dad influenced me because they were always listening to music. They had a radiogram. Remember those old things? There were even some 78 records, but they weren't theirs. They were leftovers from grandparents, although I think my mum's first record she ever bought was there. I still have it somewhere, and that was a 78. Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, Why Do Fools Fall in Love. And I can remember listening to these things and sticking my head inside the radiogram and remembering the smell of the Bakelite and the vinyl and this machine, you know, and it was kind of a magical place, this music. I can remember listening to River Deep Mountain High as well, thinking that was like being in a tunnel. So I suppose I was kind of discovering production and the sound of vocals and, you know, that whole Phil Spector wall of sound. And then there was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And I can remember I was listening to these songs like Paint It Black. Why do the Rolling Stones want to paint everything black?
And why they were ahead of their time.
Yes, exactly. That's had an effect on me. And why did the Beatles think there are 8 days a week? I can remember going to a party with my mum and dad and sneaking out of bed and coming downstairs. And it was like 8 days a week. But don't they know there are only 7 days a week? So all this music was all around.
So you said they're groovers. Can you tell me, you know, do they dress in fashion?
I can remember her dressing in head-to-toe leather with stiletto knee-high boots, leather jeans, leather top. She used to make these leather jerkins and a leather collarless jacket like the Beatles wore, and my dad had one too.
Oh my God, what a couple!
And stripy T-shirts. And, you know, my dad was a carpenter, builder and joiner. He worked for himself, and my mum had a poodle parlour.
Oh my God!
And a load of girls who worked with her who were also very groovy with their beehives and their long hair. In fact, one of my mum's specials was, I think because she tried it out on some of the girls who worked with her, the Saturday girls. They were all in their teens. At that time, people were doing beehives and black eyes. I mean, Amy Winehouse, Eat Your Heart Out. This was the ultimate look, to have the tallest beehive. But I think then they didn't have the kind of hair products they have now. And it was kind of like varnish, the stuff girls sprayed on their hair. And so my mum had this special that, as well as bathing and dressing and clipping poodles and various other breeds of dogs. She could do the best washing out of beehives. Fantastic. And lacquer and detangling of girls' hairs. And it started off from the Saturday girls and their friends, and then mothers would bring these daughters in. Can you do something with her hair? And they'd have a head like a head full of candy floss. And
of course, because to get a beehive, you have to back comb your hair completely, which obviously is so bad for it.
So
cover it in tons and tons of hairspray, then put it up, then put tons more on, you know.
And then, because you've put so much time and effort into achieving that look, sleeping in it with a headscarf or whatever to preserve it is some kind of wooden Egyptian pillow, I don't know. And so, you know, they would have to last a week, a hairdo like that. God knows what was living in there. But my mum used to use these shampoos and sometimes I think a little bit of washing powder.
God.
That was the only stuff that would get this stuff out. But then loads of conditioner to try and get the hair back to some kind of natural.
Also, she did a roaring trade in poodles and girls.
Yes.
It's brilliant. Did I read somewhere that your dad sang as well?
Yeah, he was in a band. He played bass and sang in a band, and he supported a few people. It was in the days when the, you know, bands would go on tour. I think they probably still do it in some places. And, you know, there would be a support band in the city, each city they were playing in. And so he supported people like Tom Jones and Lulu. And I can remember Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. And he had a look where he wore an eye patch and he forgot his suitcase. And my dad brought his suitcase home and got in touch with them. It had some eye patches and some other items of ladies' clothing in the suitcase. I can remember having a look. But he was so grateful that my dad had saved his touring suitcase and saved it for him that he brought me round a present, which was another sign of the time. It was a little toy washing machine that you could put real water in.
I love it. What fun. Much better than doing it in real life.
Exactly.
It sounds so this was all in Nottinghamshire.
That was in Nottinghamshire, yeah. And, you know, there were lots of parties. My mum and dad were always having parties. They lived in a flat which had this kind of funny upstairs attic space that I can remember having lots of coloured light bulbs and, you know, a little bar up there. And I can remember coming down and there were always ashtrays piled high. And that smell, I still quite like that smell of
old
ashtrays
and
bottles strewn around.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I'm quite a clean living myself.
Yeah, but it was again sign of the times, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Sounds really brilliant. So, I should say, well, I was going to say, what were your musical and visual influences when you were growing up? I mean, obviously your parents had a big influence on you. Was there anything else?
Yeah, my parents, I think really people like Dusty Springfield and Sandy Shaw, that was a little bit later. I suppose at this time it would have been more like the Beatles, you know, short hair and dressed in black and spiky shoes. But my mum's friends all had beehives or the opposite kind of bit, Bam the Bomb, long hair and duffel coats and baseball boots and duffel bags. And I think I've always been into that look. But another thing that probably influenced me was the fact that my mum wanted me to be a boy. And so my name wasn't that obviously a girl's name. Not many people had heard the name Corin in those days. So and my mum
used... Oh, Colin. Yes,
yeah. People either thought it was Colin or Corin, an Irish boy's name.
Yeah.
But my mum used to dress me up in jodhpurs and, you know, riding clothes and a little cap.
Were you going riding?
I did go riding.
Right.
She liked horse riding. She used to leave me with the stable boys and girls. I couldn't even walk, apparently, but I could cling on to a horse so I could ride before I could walk, even though I didn't particularly love it. It gave her the opportunity to go riding. And as you can see, I'm wearing jumpers today. I think all of these things, they do leave a mark. But the fact that people thought I was a boy, I really wanted, as I got a bit older, my mum used to dress me in beatnik black with tights and ballet pumps, and I had quite short hair. And all the other little girls were wearing those really frilly pink dresses with frilly bows in their hair, and they'd had their hair put in corkscrew curls and shiny shoes. And
did you want to be like them?
Yeah, I did, desperately. Do I have to wear black? I'm so glad now. I mean, I think it does... It does influence the way you are as a person and the way people react to you, really. And I think I've probably always been a bit no frills. And that was definitely a very frilly look that was around then in the early 60s. You think it was all Mary Quant. That came quite a lot later.
Onward, and especially up to Nottingham. How did your mum dye the clothes to get them black? Because it must have been very hard to find children's black clothes.
Oh, she got my auntie to knit me a big black beatnik jumper. And she used to make me clothes. I can remember her making me some bell bottoms. I had to lie on the fabric while she drew around me. But she used to make clothes out of curtains, cushion covers. I can remember op art. I had some op art shoes and she made me an op art dress to go with it. So I was her little mannequin, really.
She was very creative and dressed and made things.
Again,
an influence. When did you decide you want to be a fashion designer?
Well, I think from the age of about 6 or 7, I wanted to be a singer, and it was Sandy Shaw, I think, who really influenced me at that time. I thought, wow, I want to be like her. And I used to run around with no shoes on singing into a hairbrush. But also because she had a connection with Jeff Banks and fashion, I thought, well, maybe if I was a singer, I need to have a proper job as well. And
so,
you know, in case the singing didn't work out, maybe I'll train to be a fashion designer. So I always had this thing. I used to make clothes for my Barbie dolls out of socks. I mean, they always had to be made in the most simple way. But, you know, I think I was always torn between the two things. In between a lot of other things, I wanted to be a hotel manager once, and I wanted a rock and roll hotel with each room dedicated to a different band of my choice.
I think come on, you've still got the energy, Corin. I want this to happen.
The rock and roll hotel, There was going to be a Slade room, a David Bowie, a Mark Bolan room, a Jackson 5 room, a Supremes room. You know, the people I was into at the time. Yeah. I just thought you could have a record player with all their records.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is sort of pre-MP3 and iPlayer. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of thinking into the future. But, you know, all the colours of the room and the fabrics had to kind of match.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That. I think I'd like the Supremes room myself.
Yeah. Glitz and glamour.
Imagine disco balls and things in that room.
Yeah.
It'd be brilliant. So you grew up and went to St Martin's to study. Now that's a really hard place to get into, so you must have been very talented.
Or maybe just desperate. My parents moved from Nottingham to Lincolnshire.
That is away from everything.
And then they split up. So we were kind of left in the middle of a field, me and my mum and my brothers. And it was like, it was kind of desolate after living in a city with everything going on, all the bright lights and stuff to do, to suddenly be plonked into the middle of the countryside. My mum proceeded to shack up with a farmer, so we did help a lot on the farm and learnt about all kinds of agricultural stuff. But, you know, I just used to go on my bike and just dream of living in a city. You know, it's like I didn't really want to stay there, but it was a great place actually for not getting into trouble and for letting your imagination run wild, having a complete blank canvas, which I did, and lived out all kinds of dreams, and there was no one to stop you. You know, the world is yours in the countryside. Yeah. It is, you know, so liberating. It was a fantastic experience when I look back, but not when I was like 12, 13, 14, wanting to go to discos, wanting to meet boys and all this stuff that was kind of so out of reach. But it's good. It kept me out of trouble.
Yeah. Thank you, Corin. More from Corin after the second song that Corin chose, which is Mama Didn't Raise No Fool, and that's dedicated to her mother, and it's all about growing up in Nottingham and the poodle parlour.
To survive, daddy lied, mama cried, things I never learned in school, yes I found out all too soon, mama didn't raise no fool. Suddenly it becomes plain to see that's the
So that was Mama Didn't Raise No Fool, back to Corinne from Swing Out Sister.
So when I left school, I did a foundation course, and I was very lucky to...
Where was that?
That was in Lincoln.
Yeah.
And I was really lucky to have tutors there who had all been to the Royal College. They were great.
Wow.
And they really pushed us. They were tough and gritty. And when it came to putting down a choice, I wanted to go to college in Nottingham. And they said, oh, no, we think you should go to St. Martin's. You should give it a try. So I put that as my first choice, not thinking I'd get in. And when I did, I said, oh, I think I'll go to Nottingham or Manchester. I was a bit scared of going to London. I hadn't even been to London except for once when I was seven to go to the zoo. And they said, you're bloody well going. There were three of us who were up for interviews, and two of us were accepted. And
it's fantastic. So literally, they were an inspiration then, these teachers.
They really were. Mm. But I don't think I knew quite how special it was to go to St. Martin's.
But in a way, that probably made you less nervous about flying. Oh, they're telling me about this place. I might as well go for it. Where did you live in London? I mean, you really were Dick Whittington arriving.
It was like that, completely. It used to take me about 5 minutes to cross the road. I was just so scared. I'd come from a village where there's about one car a day, a couple of tractors and a few sheep to London. And St. Martin's is on Charing Cross Road. It's moved now to King's Cross. But, there's like five lanes of traffic and you're trying to get across the road, going on the underground. I used to walk everywhere. I lived in a hall of residence in Battersea and used to walk from Charing Cross Road to Battersea because I thought it was good exercise and I would save money.
Gosh, that's a long way.
But it was an eye-opener, I'm telling you. In those days, there were all kinds of stuff going on. Piccadilly was the kind of...
all the tramps and alcoholics, weren't they?
And the rest. Mm. All the junkies used to congregate in Piccadilly Station, and there used to be toilets in those days down in the underground station, and a pub. There was a pub that sold draft Guinness down in Piccadilly Tube Station. And I used to take a shortcut through Piccadilly Station. I can remember going to the loo once and seeing all these syringes on the roof and stuck into the ceiling of the loos and hearing people, more than one person in the cubicles, thinking, what the hell's going on in there?
You were so innocent, you just didn't know what.
I didn't know. It was a fast learning curve. But I think some of the soundtrack to this was David Bowie. And so through his lyrics, things like the London Boys and stuff like that, I learned all kinds of stuff about drugs and all the bad life and the stuff that could go on behind the scenes in London. So it was quite a fast learning curve. And just walking the streets of London really was an eye-opener. But at the same time, I loved it, It was kind of finding a complete other life.
So how old were you when you arrived?
I was 17.
Wow.
Yeah. I left school when I was 16 and did foundation and then came to London.
Amazing. Now, you wouldn't be able to get in till you're 18 now.
Well, I think they knew I was having trouble at home. My parents had split up. I was desperate to leave home because I was turning into a domestic goddess. I used to dress and feed my brothers, and I didn't want to do that anymore. As much as I loved them, I just felt like I was missing out a bit on my, my kind of teenage years. So going to St. Martin's was...
So you graduated and then were you doing any singing?
I was in a band at college called The Dads.
That's a great name.
Yeah, keep it in the family from The Dads to Swing Out Sister. And we used to play a lot of art school parties. I can remember Chelsea and Goldsmiths. And
were you the singer?
Yeah, but I had to share the singing slot with a boy because we had a very split personality. All the songs I wanted to do were like the Supremes and Motown stuff and a bit of Dusty and a bit of Petula and, 60s songs really. Mm-hmm. But the other singer, John, he used to do the punk stuff.
Oh, this is
hilarious. So I was wanting to disappear into this 60s reverie, and then he would do all the screaming, shouting punk stuff. And
hilarious.
I mean, we were an art school band. There was quite a gang
definitely.
Of us, and it was seemed to go down well at parties because there was a bit of something for everyone. And it was great for making costumes. I can remember making dresses out of leatherette and sticking them with copy decks for these gigs.
Oh, what fun.
I didn't really like punk.
No.
I thought I did. I tried to, but I wasn't wholeheartedly into it. I think
maybe you're not mean enough.
Yeah.
You're too soft.
Probably.
And you like glamour maybe too much.
Yeah. Although that was pretty glamorous. I did try sort of putting fuse wire in my hair and wearing bin liner dresses and melting stuff together with an iron and, you know, getting creative with that whole look.
So did you go to the Blitz Club and everything?
I did, but I probably wasn't enough of a show-off to be one of the Blitz kids.
So what were you wearing?
There was a theatrical agency called Charles Fox that closed down in about 1980. And I think half of St Martin's trooped over to Covent Garden. It was in Seven Dials. For a fiver, you could get a bin liner bag and fill it. Well, I think I must have had half of the extras costumes from My Fair Lady in my bag.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, that from Covent Garden in the era of My Fair Lady to Covent Garden when it was kind of a desolate wasteland apart from a shop called PX and a few theatrical and ballet shops. Mm-hmm. It was kind of it was another way to live out your dreams. Which...
So were you wearing an Edwardian costume to Blitz then? Was that look?
I think I was. I mean, I maybe wasn't quite into the... you know, ultra-modern, sucked-in purple cheeks and stuff. But I thought I was Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. That would do.
Well, you have got a look of Audrey Hepburn about you. It has to be said.
Thanks. I'm glad you think so.
So how did Swing Out Sister come about? The lads who, you know, were like started the band before you arrived, they're from Manchester. So how did they get hold of a ex-fashion student in London?
Well, it's totally by accident, like everything in my life has been, really. And it's great to embrace these happy accidents. I woke up one day, I was still designing clothes, and I can't remember if it was still for myself or for the place I went on to work at afterwards, which helped pay off my debts. But I got up one day and there were these two bodies on the living room floor, and it's like, oh god, who's there? Are always people crashing out.
Oh, is this where were you living?
It was a communal flat where we had far too many people living in a two-bedroom flat, you know, that people squeezed in to every room, and you never knew who you were going to wake up and find there in the morning. And so there were two boys, you know, just in coats on the floor, and it was cold, and I remember stepping over them thinking, and this is my flatmate Julian, who was looking after them, trying to get them a record deal. You know, he just sort of let them stay there, but he didn't even get them a blanket or anything. And so I just said, do you want a cup of tea? Because I felt a bit sorry for them. And I think they were grateful. I don't know if that's why they got me in their band. You know, a cup of tea can work wonders.
So you got chatting. They said that they had a band, but they obviously didn't have a singer then.
Yeah, no, I didn't meet them again probably for about another year. And Julian, their manager, he was my flatmate, said, oh, we're looking for a singer. I said, I'll do it. And he said, oh, no, you're far too old and you're not pretty enough.
How old were you?
I think I was 24. But you know that he was a bit younger and he was a bit of a whippersnapper, and he was looking for someone probably that he was always pretty sarcastic. No, you're too old, and you can't sing. Anyway, they couldn't find a singer. They auditioned lots of people, and I don't think Andy and Martin actually wanted a singer. They were quite happy to be doing instrumental, kind of dance, industrial, funk, New York loft-style dance stuff they were doing. In fact, they were the face of British hip-hop, I think. It was some kind of sampling and scratching stuff they were doing.
Ages before everybody.
Yeah, it was quite experimental, the stuff they were doing. And Malcolm McLaren's Dot Rock was out. It was it was that kind of era. Yeah. Anyway, they couldn't find a singer, or their manager Julian couldn't find them a singer, and he said, Corinne, you know, you said
brilliant.
And I was going, okay, all right then. But you know, I tried my hand at writing songs, which I hadn't done before. I dabbled with it and wasn't very successful, but my friend Julian had been playing some instrumental tracks in his car, and because I said, oh, I really like this, what's this? And he said, oh, this is Andy and Martin, those guys who were asleep on the floor that time. You don't fancy doing some singing with them? Oh, all right then. So I went up to Manchester armed with a few songs that I'd written, and I was very nervous and a bit embarrassed because I'd not really written any songs before in a studio with them. And I was so embarrassed I made them go out to the pub because I couldn't sing in front of them. So it was just me and the producer, a guy called Paul Roberts, who had a studio that most Manchester bands at that time, the Smiths and Simply Red, Lisa Stansfield, all the people who were emerging and up and coming, they'd all done their demos in this studio. Sent the boys off to the pub, managed to get these tracks down. I think I'd done 3 or 4 songs. And they came back a bit worse for wear. And they go, yeah, great. And I never know to this day, was it just because they'd had too much to drink? Or was I really that brilliant? I don't think so.
So do you play an instrument or do you just make up songs in your head?
No, I don't play an instrument. I did attempt piano, guitar and every other. I can fumble my way through something if I have to, but no, I wouldn't want to. Andy is just so brilliant at what he does, and it's great. I'm really spoilt if he'll write a piece of music and I write some lyrics to it. And
so you're more of a lyricist, are you?
Yeah. Well, we work on some things together. It depends. But that's quite often how it works. And no matter how many little notes and jottings I write down, usually when Andy writes a piece of music, I'll react to it and I'll write whatever it makes me feel or think. And it might be referring to something or other that I've been writing. But I consider myself as an instrument. I don't write lyrics necessarily to make any great political point or statement. I write them as a part to go along with the music, so it enhances what's there. And I often think a lot of the songs that I like, it's not particularly what they're saying, it's how they make you feel. You know, if the right words hit the music at the right time, it does a wonderful thing and it opens this pocket in your mind. And I think if you can try too hard to make words make sense, to make things rhyme, to make stuff happen, then it's more like a poem put to music. You do only need to accompany yourself on a guitar. You know, it's like folk music, like hip-hop. The music's not so important, but I think I'm very fortunate in that Andy writes such great music. I react to it, so I add something to enhance it.
So Andy and you are still writing together. So we've heard about your music in the 80s. What are you up to now then?
Well, now we've done quite a lot of touring in the last few years. We didn't do that so much when we started out because I realised that, you know, after that experience on the tour bus, I thought I was getting in a band to go on tour and do live stuff. Andy was sick of schlepping around in a van, which he'd done for several years with a certain ratio. He was ready to stay in the studio, write songs, make videos, anything but do that gruelling touring thing. Yeah. And that's all I wanted to do. So I was a bit disappointed. But then when we did start travelling, it was mainly to do TV appearances and a few gigs, but it was always jet-setting off on a plane, staying in swanky hotels, and it was fantastic. I'm not complaining.
You don't see the country.
But deep in my heart, I wanted to be on a tour bus. So Andy didn't come on a couple of tours. He'd had enough and he wanted to do stuff in the studio. So I said, oh, well, do you mind if I go without you? No. And, you know, he worked on the arrangements and stuff with the band, but he didn't actually come. So we got a tour bus.
Great.
And we drove across America in a tour, but it was like a dream come true. This was a few years ago. I mean,
really only materialized a few years ago.
It didn't happen until I was 42.
Oh, brilliant.
And it's like, how long did it take, my God, to get on that tour bus? But it was everything I had imagined and dreamt it could be. Everyone else in the band at the time had been on tour buses before and they weren't very excited about it at all. And we arrived, we were in Chicago in a hotel, and then the bus was picking us up from there to continue around America down to Miami or somewhere, I can't remember.
So you saw it, didn't you? You saw it out the window. So it wasn't like flying, it was much more interesting.
You could see the world whizzing by. And I said to the band, oh, is somebody bagging me a top bunk? And they go, yeah, and got on the bus. There's like 9 or 12, I can't remember, bunks in a bus. It was a huge, great thing. It's like a house on wheels. It's got its own kitchen and bathroom and the bar, you know, and a DVD viewing room at the back. And it was amazing. But
God,
I really,
lucky you waited till you're 42, because I can't have been as swanky as that.
Oh, no, the one I looked at wasn't, but it was very magical. It wasn't that swanky, but it was magical. I mean, in my mind, at 3 or 4 years old. But this bus, I can remember, you know, we had a few drinks and we were whizzing down a freeway somewhere and people were gradually going to bed. I was so excited and dancing, drinking, listening to the music, thinking about our next day's gig. And then it came to bedtime and I was one of the last people to go to bed. And then I realised why nobody else was on a top bunk. I couldn't get up there because the bus is rocking and you're, you know, being projected down the freeway at God knows how many miles an hour. And everyone else is in bed and they have a little curtain. It was kind of like Some Like It Hot. Yeah. And you have to climb on someone else's bed to get on your bed. Oh, so really, God. I suppose if you're in the top bunk, it would be well-mannered to go to bed first so your foot doesn't end up in someone's face. And my feet did end up in people's faces. And I can remember Sylvia, the backing vocalist, sleeping underneath me, grabbing hold of my leg, going, "Will you shut up?" And I got in bed and all I could do was giggle. All I could do was giggle, giggle. I was so happy. I was so over the moon in this little capsule. You know, you.
Can I just ask, what if you wanted to go to the loo in the night?
Well, luckily I didn't. But if you do, it's okay. There is a toilet on the bus.
Oh, good.
But there is a strictly no solids rule on any tour bus.
God!
You have to wait till morning.
Oh, my God.
There are truck stops that have showers and loos and everything. And most venues that you get to, because they're used to people doing their tours this way. You know,
great, so you can
washing
facility. When you arrive.
Yeah, but also we were a bit spoiled. We stopped at a motel most mornings. And so then we had a room for the boys and a room for the girls, and we could all just go and get dressed and polished and be all
freshen up,
ready for the next day. But the great thing was, after a gig, you could come out of the gig, and if you wanted to stay up and have a drink in the bar or whatever, you could. And if you wanted to go to bed, the bus was outside.
Brilliant.
I never
Brilliant.
Wanted to go to bed, though. I was so excited.
You were really acting like a real rocker, weren't you? Yeah, I'm just partying all night, you know, with my groupies.
It was fantastic. It was the best thing. We did two of those tours with the bus. One of the best things about it was that it was an expando bus. So when it parked up, Dave, the driver, pressed a button and the living room area went twice as wide.
Oh, no, this is just too good to be true.
I was thinking, has somebody spiked my drink? I'm sure this room was half the size when I came in.
Not everybody should have one of these tour buses.
I know. I was seriously thinking of selling my house to get a tour bus. I thought you could constantly keep moving.
So maybe you've got some gypsy blood.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I think I probably
sounds
have.
Like it. You're a traveller, aren't you?
Yeah.
It's fantastic. So your last album was only released in Japan. Can you tell me why?
If it's Private View you're talking about, it was released in Japan first, but it has now worked its way around the world.
Okay.
It's been released in Europe and it just came out in America. We do things ourselves now. We're not signed to a major label, so if we make an album, it's kind of, you license it through various territories, and it's probably better for them if they don't all release it at once, because it's kind of like getting back to the old days in a way.
Yeah, in a way, you've done it the other way around to everybody else. You know, you had a proper record company and now you're doing it yourself.
Yeah, but I think that's the way now. It's the wonder of the internet.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's brilliant.
I have embraced it now. I was a late developer.
Yeah.
I didn't really think much of it when it started out, because I like to see people face to face. I like to do things with people and be involved, and it's a bit solitary and a bit distant, but you know, it's kind of you know, we're on first name terms with a lot of our audience on Facebook, and
really
they write to us and they arrange little gatherings when we do gigs. They'll meet people from all corners of the world. We'll meet, you know,
of course, it really helps with gatherings, communities. So you've got a Swing Out Sister community out
there. I think we have.
I'm just trying to get the Japan angle, because apparently you are very famous there. Tell me about it.
I don't think we're that famous there, but I think with Japan, it's got a huge population, and that whole big in Japan thing is, you don't have to be that big to be big in Japan, because, you know, it's about three times the population of England anyway.
Is it?
But
England's 58 million. Gosh.
Yeah, I think it's about 125 in Japan.
Wow. So have they kept loyal to you, or have you got new fans in Japan?
They're very loyal. I think the thing is with the Japanese, they like to collect sets of things. I mean, you see that in their shops and in the style of things. They like one in each colour. They like to have a set. I think they would not feel happy unless they had several of your records.
That's perfect.
But I think also, well, we have a lot in common with the Japanese. They're very loyal. They're very polite. It's almost like going back, well, that was in the 80s. It's a couple of decades on now. It was a bit like going back to the 50s. People were still very courteous and very polite. I mean, there are probably some other things that went along with that that, you know, weren't so great. I don't think their women were really probably as liberated as women in the Western world. But, you know, everything takes its time. And I think they were embracing the Western world as we were embracing various other Japanese cultures, so we had a mutual appreciation society in a way. But I always wanted to go to Japan since I was little, so, you know, a lot of my wishes came true. I think I wished very hard, and it was a great place to visit, full of mystique and mystery, but it's quite inspiring because it's a culture that's so different.
Everyone says, I mean, I haven't been, but they say it's the most kind of alien place, that it's so different than us.
Yeah, it's not so much now. I think the world's getting smaller, the sort of globalization, the internet.
Yeah.
We kind of...
we're homogenizing, aren't we?
We really are. Mm. But when we first went there, it hits you like, wow, this place...
Culture.
...is very different.
Yeah, culture shock. Yeah. Fascinating. So when you go on an aeroplane and you arrive in Japan, I mean, is the photographers there and things? Is it that?
Not really. They're quite polite and restrained. I think it's probably more the people. I can remember we were once walking down the street somewhere, and there were a gaggle of Japanese schoolgirls who have the most amazing uniforms, which I'm lucky enough to possess one. They have like a sailor collar. They used to, I'm not sure they do now, seem to have the same uniform, like navy blue pleated skirt and a sailor collar. And the boys all wore these black Nehru jackets with gold buttons.
I mean,
they really looked fantastic. But these girls came up and they're all gasping. And I said to Andy, do you think something's wrong? Because they're all like... And I think something's happened to one of them. But it turned out they had recognised us, but they're kind of too shy to say. They were just like making these polite little gasps. But they're very loyal people. I mean, they're great. When they come to our gigs, they hang on to every note and they will tell you about it. Oh, you changed this from last time and you've added a section of this and you paid tribute to Marvin Gaye in this song and, you know, at
Bar
92.
So really quite computing. Their brains really are. Everything's, you know, they're kind of analysing.
Yeah, very analytical. Mm. And they just pay attention to detail, you know, are appreciative. So I think it's probably because of the Japanese. Whenever we go on tour, we completely change our set. We completely change our songs because we know they will take note if we haven't.
Oh, it sounds lovely. So in a way, as you say, they keep you going. Your fans sort of, you know, they push you on, don't
they? Yeah, they really do.
So what's Swing Out Sisters' future plans then? Because you've been going for 27 years, I realised. I got someone to do the maths in the office.
Oh my goodness, yeah. It's quite a while.
I mean, you're becoming like the kind of Rolling Stones or something.
Yeah, not quite. Not quite as raunchy.
Yeah, what I mean is that in your longevity, I mean, you're doing brilliantly, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I think we're kind of happy to do what we do. We love what we do. Sometimes it comes fast and furious. Sometimes it's a bit more sedate and slowed down. But whatever we do, we make sure we like it and we'll adapt it. You know, we've made a few short films and stuff like that, or done music to short films and made a few little films of just behind the scenes stuff. And I think we just add things to what we do to keep it ticking over and keep it interesting. This last album we did actually came about because of a rehearsal for an American tour that was cancelled due to the Icelandic volcano.
Well.
And we changed all the songs for the American tour and got a slightly different band together, more acoustic sounding jazz arrangements of our songs. And I knew if we didn't record it, by the time we got to doing our next gigs, we would have changed all the songs and no one would have heard them. So I go, Andy, although we cannot now go to America to do our tour, and we're all geared up for it. It's a bit like training for the Olympics. You know, you get fit, you get focused, you become these songs. So we've got to put them down and record them. And we did. But then we went off and did our various other tours and gigs that had been booked. So it wasn't till a year or so later we came back to listen to the volcano sessions.
Yeah.
And then we added stuff to them and mixed them. And that became our latest record, Private View, which was kind of a bit of a private peekaboo behind the scenes look into us in a rehearsal studio. We developed it so it was recorded in a recording studio, but we just recorded our rehearsals and then mixed the tracks and added some other moods and flurries and fancies to it. And we also recorded some of our Japanese tour. And this was really all to make available to the American audiences who missed out because we couldn't do that tour, which we still haven't done because you have to book things up so far in advance.
So you're going to do American home tour soon?
Hopefully later this year, but I'm a bit nervous. I'm thinking, what other natural disaster? We almost were going to do one at the end of last year when the hurricane happened.
So do you believe that maybe when you plan your tours, the natural disasters follow?
I don't know. Maybe we're just unlucky. I wouldn't want to go as far as to say we caused them. But we have been in Japan in earthquakes several occasions. When we've been in Japan, there have been earthquakes. Scary. And also in America. I think it was actually the same earthquake or the same movements, you know, the knock-on effect. By the time we got to San Francisco, the San Andreas Fault was moving. You know, but you don't really have to think about these things because otherwise you'd talk yourself out of anything.
Exactly, everything.
We've had some very funny happenings and some quite strange happenings on tour, but the next thing we're working on is a big band. And we've...
That is my dream. It's going to be brilliant. I'm definitely going to come and see you.
Well, we did do one gig in London. It was a bit of a tryout gig, but it was all came about because I didn't know what to get Andy for his birthday, for his 50th birthday. And he'd helped me organise such a nice party and he didn't want a party. I'm going, what do you want? Oh, I don't know. I don't want to do anything. You know what boys are like. They don't want to make a fuss. Yeah. I thought he's always wanted a big band. So I got him a big band. Except he had to work for it because he had to work on the arrangements with Noel Langley, the trumpet player. Who plays with us and who had got the band together. Well, 15.
Wow.
I think.
Did it really help singing with a band, that big band? Because I was thinking in a way it would be, or is it harder? Did they follow you?
No, it's quite nerve-wracking actually to do with a big band.
So you followed them?
Because they are playing to music. If it's with a smaller session, if I make a mistake...
Yeah, they just cover it up. Yeah.
Everyone can adapt, but it's kind of confusing to know what to do, although they're all professional musicians and they would be able to catch up and cover. Because there's, you know, there's nine people all playing the score, you know, they have to decide what to do.
Actually very nerve-wracking. Where did you perform?
Well, we performed at a jazz festival in Jakarta. We did it firstly for Andy's birthday, then a jazz festival in Jakarta with a big band who we hooked up with there. They were an American big band, so that was even more nerve-wracking. But, I mean, I was the one who kind of got us into this. And it's so luxurious. We did another gig in London last summer, and that was great at the Assembly Rooms. And hopefully we'll be able to do that again. It was so luxurious to have to be surrounded by the sound of a big band.
Oh, I know.
It's just fantastic. I mean, it's just so, well, all I can say is it's luxurious to have all those harmonies and all those vibrations surrounding you.
Perfect.
So we've recorded the big band and hopefully we are going to be doing more big band stuff in the future.
Corinne Drury from Swing Out Sister, it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you today and thank you for coming on Radio Gorgeous.
And thank you. And you're looking rather gorgeous, I hasten to add, Josephine.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you so much, Corinne, for your wonderful interview today. You really are brilliant. We love you on Radio Gorgeous. And if you'd like to know more about Swing Out Sister and their gigs and what's coming up, go to swingoutsister.com. And we finish the show with Break Out, the dance version. Go, Corinne, go.
Expectations gone.
Radio Gorgeous, we'll never let you down.